Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for what I hope will be a very interesting discussion around some of the latest data in rheumatology. I'm Professor Peter Nash from the Griffith University in beautiful downtown Brisbane, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jake Waddell, who's an academic rheumatology trainee at the Leeds Institute of Rheumatic and Musculoskeletal Medicine at the Leeds Teaching Hospital NHS Trust. And today, Jake's joining us to discuss one of his recent papers, which looks at the real-world experience of IL-17A inhibition, and it's the drug survival in a large cohort of axSpA and PsA patients, recently published in the Rheumatology Advances in Practice section in their, let me see which edition, in their February this year edition. Welcome, Jake. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself first? Where you're working, what you're doing, what your interests are?
Hello, Professor Nash. Thank you for having me. So I am a, as you said, a academic rheumatology trainee based here in Leeds in the UK. My interests are particularly around spondyloarthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and treatment response and imaging in particular, and that's what I'm working on currently.
So this particular study looked at drug survival, which is a good surrogate for still working and not having side effects, over a number of patients. You'll tell us all about how you found them and over a length of time. And you're basically comparing secukinumab and ixekizumab for patients, and you mix the axSpA and the PsA together. So tell us how you went about. First of all, what was your aim? What were you trying to show, and how you went about doing it?
Yeah, so we wanted to explore in our practice what the real-world evidence was of the IL-17A inhibitor drug survival in patients with axial spondyloarthritis and psoriatic arthritis. We wanted to compare between the two diseases and see if there was a difference in retention between them. We also wanted to compare between ixekizumab and secukinumab itself, but unfortunately, we didn't have enough axial spondyloarthritis patients on ixekizumab to make that comparison.
So, is there any background NICE related, British Trust related reasons why 117 is chosen over another in your particular region?
It's a good question. Not really. I think it's mainly down to the fact of when they were first approved. So secukinumab was first approved by NICE for axial spondyloarthritis back in 2018, whereas ixekizumab was only licensed in 2021. And this is data we've captured up until December 2022. So it's a relatively short period of time for us to collect enough numbers for the axial spondyloarthritis patients on ixekizumab.
And one of the things I've noticed in Europe that the access to the 300 dose can be difficult. So in the main, are you using 150 of secukinumab or 300 of secukinumab?
Good question. It's a little bit challenging to say. We weren't able to quite accurately capture that data, unfortunately. In the UK, there are quite stringent criteria for receiving the 300 milligram dosage around presence of psoriasis and these sorts of things. So we have to go back and look at that.
Well, it's important. Well, it's controversial and important. We use 300 routinely because it's flat pricing. We think the efficacy is better and there's no safety signal. So it might affect both response and outcome and survival. So it's an important question. But interestingly, when Novartis did a study in axSpA comparing the 150 and the 300, there wasn't any difference at the end of the study. So even though that's our clinical impression, the data certainly didn't back it up. So tell us about how you went about the methods, inclusion and exclusion type criteria.
So this was a retrospective service analysis. We identified all patients from our internal biologic registry. who'd been on ixekizumab or secukinumab at any point up until December 2022. We then included them if they had a diagnosis of axial spondyloarthritis or psoriatic arthritis. Then looked through their records, extracted their demographics, when they started the drug, the reasons, whether or not they stopped the drug, and if they did stop, why they stopped the drug.
And tell us, so you had a couple of hundred patients, mainly 91 odd AxSpA, 137 PSA. Was there significant differences between the two disease groups?
So in terms of demographics or results,
Yeah,
or
demographics.
they were relatively similar demographic-wise. There were a few key differences, though. So they were similar in terms of age, length of disease, similar in terms of the numbers of previous biologics. They'd a median two previous biologics in both these groups. There were some difference in terms of the sex splits. So there were more males in the AxSpA group compared to the PSA group. There's a those are the bit of a difference in smoking rates as well. When we looked at the data and we corrected for some of these factors like age, sex, and previous biologic usage, it still didn't change the fact that there was no difference in overall survival between AxSpA and PSA.
Okay, so we'll come to the results. So they failed a couple of biologics. So this is a difficult patient group. So presumably they failed a couple of TNFs before they got to the 17 inhibitor. One of the things that we're seeing occasionally, I don't know if you could capture it, is that if someone has an issue with one of the 17s, either loss of effect or something else, they can switch to the other 17 inhibitor and still get a good response. Because ixi came later, do you think there's a number of failed IL-17 inhibitors and patients in the ixi group particularly?
Potentially, yeah, that's something we definitely would need to look into in a little bit more detail to tease those numbers out. But definitely, it is a strategy that we do in TNF as well that we like to see
Right.
with the
So
central.
some of those. The two biologics, you'll know what they were, and I just wonder how many is 17 to 17. It'd be an interesting thing point to look at because it hasn't been clearly published very often. Some decent data on switching 17. IBD, what was the number of people who had IBD, small or large, going into the study? Were they allowed?
Very low numbers of IBD. We had one in the PSA group overall at 137 and three in the AxSpA group out of 91 with a background of IBD. But remember, this came relatively early on. Some of these patients were recruited relatively early on post-approval of these drugs.
And you didn't see any signal with IBD over your duration of follow-up?
No, we didn't see a significant signal. I think we had one or two who developed IBD after the whole cohort.
I mean, that's an important issue. If you've not had a history, you develop for the first time, I'm not sure the patient would be very happy. So tell us a little bit about, if there's going to be a problem with numbers affecting your outcome, or you can might quite reasonably show these numbers are reasonable.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
So what, like, are your numbers large enough to really make comparisons between diseases and between drugs?
I think we've got a reasonable number to compare between diseases, the 137, the PSA, and the 91 with AxSpA for this purpose. I think in terms of better and more accurate and safety analysis, I think we'd need much larger numbers and registry level data really to fully explore that.
But it is real world data. So it is patients with comorbidities and co-medications who couldn't get into a clinical trial. So it is important data. I wonder how many of your PSA patients had axial disease. Would that have been teased out when you analyzed them?
We've definitely got that data within our database, but I don't have it to hand right now, I'm afraid.
Be worth looking again, because there's this constant argument about peripheral arthritis in AxSpA, that psoriasis is just AxSpA with a rash, psoriatic arthritis, I mean. So you've included big numbers, you've followed them. There's a B27 difference, as you'd expect. IBD numbers were very small. Uveitis, you had about 10 to 20% of your patients had uveitis. Again, you can't give us any comment over the duration of follow-up, what happened to uveitis over that period of time.
Say that again, sorry.
What happened to uveitis in your patient population with these medications?
Yeah, difficult to say. I don't, again, we'd have to tease that out. There are a few patients with uveitis. I'm not sure, I don't think anyone developed uveitis while they were on these medications. We'd have to look a bit deeper in terms of kind of flare-ups or how their control of their uveitis was.
And you did look at reasons for drug discontinuation, because the numbers were quite high. Almost half your patients discontinued. About a third for primary non-response, another third or so for secondary. Can you tell us a little bit about drug discontinuation and the reasons for that?
So that's very interesting, because what we found is a difference in the reasoning between the AxSpA and the PSA. So patients with AxSpA tended to have primary non-response. That was the main reason they discontinued their drug, whereas those with PSA tended to have a secondary non-response. Whether this is due to the fact that the IL-17A was giving good psoriasis control and the people with PSA were willing to tolerate, to try it for a little bit longer, see if it started having an effect on the joints, difficult to say, but the overall survival was then the same afterwards.
And again, how did you define primary non-response? Was this people at 12 weeks who had no clinical response? How did you define both primary and secondary?
So we use primary non-response defined as if you stop the drugs within 6 months of starting, or secondary non-response was 6 months after starting. Those are the definitions we utilize.
Okay, and you've got about a quarter getting side effects. What kinds of things did you see that were the side effects in the study?
A reasonable variety. Most commonly were the usual things we'd expect: injection site reactions, those sorts of things. What was that? Hello?
Yeah, it's all good.
All good.
Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry about that. Okay. The majority were the usual sorts of things in terms of injection site reactions, those sorts of issues. There were a few others, some fatigue, some gastrointestinal disturbances, headaches, mouth ulcers rarely seen, those sorts of things.
And just out of curiosity, because ixekizumab is not as fully humanized as secukinumab is, and it's supposed to have a few more injection site reactions and a few more anti-drug antibodies, did you actually see any difference in injection site reactions that you're aware of?
Not really. I mean, they were relatively, you know, the more common reason for stopping, but there was only 4 patients in total had these injection site reactions. I'm not 100% certain how many were secukinumab, how many were ixekizumab. So it was a relatively uncommon side effect.
So that's important, because that's one of the things that is supposed to distinguish them, but in the real world, it didn't seem to make a difference. Tell us a little bit about that Kaplan-Meier curve in figure one. What did you show? What were the main results of your study?
So from the Kaplan-Meier curve, we've shown that the drug survival of 1 year in AxSpA was 63%, and in PSA it was 73%. Then at 2 years, the drug survival was 53% in AxSpA and 65% in PSA. We then performed some log rank analysis and found that there was no difference in the survival curve between the AxSpA and the PSA survival curve. And then we did Cox proportional hazards and looked at whether or not adjusting for age, sex, previous biologic use, influencing outcomes. And still, even when adjusting to those confounding factors, there's no association between drug survival and overall diagnosis.
And any predictors from your baseline of those who do well or those who discontinue? There was a nice paper published that showed if you filled out a questionnaire before you start treatment, you can predict who's going to have a side effect and you can predict who's going to have a lack of efficacy. Was there any predictors that you can tell us?
I mean, the main ones were kind of previous. One second. Yeah, not from our analysis. I don't think we actually fully looked into that. Which characteristics were the ones that were going to predict the overall survival? We did look at the deep biologic naive versus exposed and found no difference still. But we need to dig deep and do a bit more of a regression analysis to try and find out which factors predict who remained on the drug and who ceased the drug.
Very, very important question, really. Nice that there was no difference amongst them. More 17 inhibitors coming, bevacizumab, is that available in the UK market yet?
Yeah, that has now been approved for both psoriatic arthritis and axial SVA here in the UK.
And you, does this speak to you where you should put the 17s in the treatment algorithm? Or are they always going to stay after prior biologics because that's what NICE insists on?
I think as it stands, that's where they're going to stay is after a TNF inhibitor, mainly because that's, as you said, that's we are governed by what NICE tell us essentially. So unless there's a contraindication to a TNF, we usually start with a TNF, both because we've used these drugs for years, so we know quite a lot about their safety, efficacy, and side effect profile.
These drugs are off patent and therefore cheaper.
Well, it's interesting because for us, it's safety is the key. And if you can't show much difference in efficacy, like the SURPASS study comparing adalimumab and secukinumab, whether you look clinically or at x-ray progression, we go for the safer drug, and the 17s and the 23s are certainly very impressive safety. Tell us a little bit about a take-home message for the clinician from this kind of study, and then where you plan to go to next.
Yes, the take-home message is that this supports the use of IL-17A inhibitors in axial spondyloarthritis and psoriatic arthritis. This helped contribute to the real-world evidence supporting their use. In the future, we would like to repeat this analysis and hopefully have enough numbers to compare secukinumab and ixekizumab, hopefully start looking at bimekizumab as well, the dual IL-17A and F inhibitor, and then start looking a bit more about, again, positioning of the drugs and how we adequately or how best to sequence these drugs, because these are obviously, we're using this in people who've failed prior treatment with TNF inhibitors. And as you've said to your practice in Australia, where you tend to start with an IL-17A inhibitor compared to us starting with TNF inhibitor, which is the best sequencing of these medications and switching strategies and those sorts of aspects.
That would be very helpful if you could do include TNFs in a comparison in these two diseases. Because real-world data is what we need now. We've got all the clinical trial program going out for a decade, and we need to know if the safety stacks up in patients with real comorbidities and concomitant medication who would never get into a clinical trial. So a very nice study. Congratulations on examining an important question. We need to know why people either partially, primarily or secondarily fail over time, which is, you know, 40% of your patients have churned within a year, and would be nice to know why that is. Are there predictors? You've shown that it's not because they've failed therapy previously, which is interesting. I would have thought that that would be the case. No difference between the two clinically, and you're out to a couple of years, and we appreciate you your time. Thank you very much, Jake. If you'd like to know more about this paper and others uploaded to the IMID Forum website, you can get detailed slide sets are available in the publication section, imidforum.com. Please subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or other podcast media. Let us know what you think. You can watch this on YouTube. And finally, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook to keep up with the latest information. This nice paper has been published in the British Society of Rheumatology Rheumatology Journal in February of this year. Thanks very much for your time, Jake.
Thanks very much for having me.